People say, well, how do you know you got the right Bible? And they come off the wall with ignorant statements like there are no manuscripts past the 5th or 6th century. Not true. As I move on in Romans, I will probably hand out copies of a 2nd century manuscript when I'm deciphering a critical text. What I've written on the board is going to demonstrate the way translations work, and hopefully, if I succeed at the end of the message, give you more confidence, even in the Bible you may be reading that is less than perfect. But I hope before I finish you will see how safe we are in the perpetuation of God's Word through the centuries. There is no written document on this earth that has received more critical attention and more devoted care than the Scriptures, Old and New Testament. Now, what I've written on the board starts with the Hebrew, but I want to start with the 6th section here, which is the King James Version, which you have in front of you, most of you. And we're teaching a practical excursion in faith, jumping off of a pause that I've done going through Romans. Since the theme of Romans is from faith to faith, and you learn faithing by practicing. God knows that, which is why He puts you in situations where you have to practice. I'm giving you some chairs to sit in and stomp on. Verses that are available to hang your body on. A lifestyle of using God's Word where you live. And we've been camping out in the 91st Psalm, which is one of the greatest psalms ever written. It's inspired many songs. It's traditionally in the church. It's been read before Lent. Many people memorize it, but it's got a lot of poetic words, and we're trying to pull those words into life action. Useful meaning. There are three voices. And this is review. Three voices in the 91st Psalm. A voice that opens it and makes a declaration of what's available to faithers. The second verse is a response by the person that represents us, if you really get into this song. And he responds with a declaration, and that's why I've left this section of the board alone, which has those verses that I will return to, the first and second verse. After the response of faith in the second verse, the first voice takes over again and tells in a lot of detail what's available to those that act in faith. I said a couple of weeks ago, do you really believe this stuff? No, I don't sometimes. The promises of this chapter are so mind-boggling. Every day I doubt them. I'm going to tell you something, let you know a secret. I'm a preacher's kid. I grew up around preachers. I was the research director for the Committee on Advance to Reorganize the Assemblies of God. I preached the message at the Kiel Auditorium on the meaning and message of the church, which, by the way, Jack Hayford sat on our set and said that night he made the commitment that produced Church on the Way. I was the first teacher, the largest church in the world in Seoul, Korea. Sat with the missionary's trailer and said to Cho Yoon-ji, you can take handouts from missionaries the rest of your life, or you can start practicing faith. because God's still alive here as he is in America. And he sat on our set and said that was the turnaround until he built the largest church in the world. They now send missionaries everywhere. They send them here from Korea. I could go on. I came here as president of our denomination and then chose to leave that post to concentrate on the church. But I want to tell you something, whether they admit it or not, every preacher has the same problem. We're all alike, struggling in this battle of faith. The word stays the same. Our progress is one of growth. My God, I say, I wish I could just live on this, the cusp of this, and just know. When I get up every morning, God will give his angels charge over me. And it doesn't say you won't go where stones are. It just says they'll guard you lest you stumble over. Man, I come out in the morning. God is not very close to me until I get my eyes open. And I stagger to the bathroom and, another day of no sleep because somebody's done something in the neighborhood that woke me up. And then somewhere about halfway through the teeth brushing business or something else, I say, whoa. Pray lest ye enter into temptation. And then I start doing what I'm telling you to do. Talk from the heart, man believes with the mouth, declaration is made. I start talking faith, if it's just a whisper. I don't do it every time, but I've learned before I swing my legs out of the bed, not as some form, rote, meaningless act, to pray, lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from evil, because I know it's going to come today. So I don't want you to think that I'm preaching these things and I'm up there. I know that God's word's forever settled in heaven. I settle my faith from a study of the resurrection. I know the stamp of God's authority that Jesus himself put on the Psalms, which he quoted so often. And I know that faith begins by getting your mind adjusted from the seen to what is not seen. We look on the things which are not seen, for they're eternal, and that faith begins by accepting the fact that God spoke and not a thing became everything, and his word's more real than what I see. Not some fancy, stupid appearance and reality argument. This world is real, and I can stub my toe on solid matter, and I ain't walking in front of a streetcar to prove it isn't there. I've studied all of those religions. They're real, but there's something more real. And we look not on things which are seen, because the things which are seen are temporal. The things which are not seen are eternal. That's what faith is. It grabs hold of. Faith is substantiating that which is hoped for, evidencing, working it out to be seen. And this psalm is so full of promises. If you can get in the receiving end, and it starts with dwelling in the help zone. I've been over that. Don't want to repeat it today. Got too much to do. And the psalmist keeps going, the first voice telling the good news. The first voice. About the ninth verse. There's a lot of debate about this, but I'm on the side of those that say the father got so caught up, he interrupted and gave a second ejaculation of just bursting forth of faith. And then the promises heap up some more. You come to the 14th verse, God starts talking. He's watched it. He's listened to the one that's saying what the promises are. He's listened to the faith response which you and I can give. And when you're in that faithing zone, talk yourself right into it. God says this, because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high. Now, I submit that that doesn't mean any more to the average Christian than the first verse of this chapter means. Remember the first verse? We had to pull it apart. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide. Remember that? What's a secret place? Well, it feels good. And I've watched Christians get into these feeling modes, and then they go out. There's no substance for the walk. We pulled that first verse apart. I think it has more meaning to you now than it did when we started, right or wrong? I don't think this has too much meaning to most of you. It sounds good. Because he has set his love upon me. Now, exactly how do you go about setting your love on somebody? I've had some people set their love on me. I wish they'd set it somewhere else. How do you just go about setting your love on somebody? Now, the Bible talks about faith, hope, and love. Love is something that happens. If you have to ask if you're in love, you ain't. And there are some listening to me who wish that they'd been told that long ago. Love happens. Faith, with rare exceptions of God just intensifying the gift of faith in someone and they have a moment of epiphany in which they really believe they can pick a tree up and throw it in the ocean. But faith is not something that just happens. Faith cometh by hearing, hearing by the Word of God. Faith in that text in Romans, from faith to faith, is in the genitive when it starts out. In the Greek syntax, that means it originates. It starts something. It is the originator is doing something. That's why we have Genesis and genitals and genetic and all the other words that talk about beginning something. I can start faith from faith in the genitive to faith in the accusative where I become the recipient. God adds to what I start. And I learn by faithing, and each step of the way gets a little stronger along the road as I learn to lean on God's Word, learn to run to His Word for shelter, and I can sometimes and more frequently, thank God, come to the point where I can say, amen, it's a state of mind. He's going to do what He said. Faith, you can do. Love happens. That means most of you are left out in the cold because love, at first sight, is pretty rare in the seen world. And considering the fact that what Isaiah said is too often true, truly thou art a God that hideth thyself, He works in the invisible. It's pretty hard to have love at first sight with God. And we're talking about personal relationship and a personal God. That's why it's poetically great. And it has manifold meaning to those that have walked the faith walk and have had God come on the scene. I'm quite sure you love God a great deal more now than you did when you were here the last time because of what you've experienced in the relationship. But I got people that are just starting the walk. And love kind of doesn't do it. Because He had set His love upon me. Yes, I've often said to you, I've said it to my wife, if I have to choose between her trusting me and loving me, I'll take the trust. Because if I can't be trusted and she can't trust me, love won't last. It's just that simple. Love cannot stay in an untrusting relationship. Love happens, love is maintained by a myriad number of contributors. The trust is way up there at the head of the line. Faith, hope, and love. Well, faith is the substance of things hoped for. Now, obviously, Paul's talking to the Corinthians in that 13th chapter that are self-centered, competitive, and the greatest of these traits to operate in that congregation is love. But in relation to God, faith takes front seat. And faith is the substance of things hoped for. And the faithfulness of God engenders love. That's why I want to pull this English apart and show you where it comes from. Therefore, because he said, I really don't want to think that God's only going to deliver those gushing woo-woo people that are, I've even heard some preachers in there that thank God for Dr. Tozer, there is no relationship between the libido and the spiritual. Sorry, nothing wrong with the libido, I'm glad I got it. Most preachers won't admit it. But, you know, I get the scrunchies when I hear a preacher say, make love to Jesus. The Jesus I know will smack him. I don't want to think that God's deliverance is only to those gushing spiritual weirdos. I will deliver the him. Who? Who's the him? Well, because he set his love upon me. And I will set him on high. Now what in the world does that mean? That's as bad as the earlier verse, but I don't want to preach that message, I already did. I will set him on high. What's that mean? One-upmanship spiritually? I'm above all of you. What's that mean? I mean, if your life depended on defining what I will set him on high means, you're going to die. Most of you. I will set him on high. Now, don't read into this, you old-time Christians that have heard 5,000 messages on this passage. Don't read into it your understanding. Jesus took the gospel, took the word eternal from facing God, struck a tent in human flesh, and brought it where ordinary people lived. That's what we're trying to do. Where did this translation come from? Therefore, I will set him on high. Number one, I'm not going to get delivered unless I got the adequate measure of love, whatever that means, in behavioral terms, and I will not be set on high, and I don't know what being set on high is. So let's go back. The Hebrew has it. This is asseverity, to use a long word, but I think it should be translated yea, or truly or surely, but it also has the alternative, because, which most translations take up. So let's stick with that. Because to me, the translation, KB, he clings, is the way most Hebrew English books will translate it. But it's deeper than that. It is devoted clinging. It carries with it the meaning of trusting relationship, which motivates the cling. It's not the kind of clinging I preached about in the story of Jacob, where you're facing your nature and you're honestly recognizing your desperate condition of alienation and going your own way, and you're wrestled down, and you can't get away with it any longer, and you face yourself, and you're reduced to sheer clinging. That's not what's carried in this word. This word is devotional clinging. It's trusting clinging. It's, I'm drowning, might be allowed, a cousin, I would say, to Jacob's condition that clings to the life raft because you trust it to keep you on the surface. Because he clings in that sense. And that's why I think this is, as a verity, if we say, yea, to me he clings, then the conjunction makes sense, and here's your personal pronoun, I, and here is the central verb, plot, and this suffix is to him. Because to me, he trustingly holds. Yea is better. To me, he trustingly holds. And I will set him free. I will deliver him, but more in the sense of setting free. You know what's really interesting? I'm going to read you some scribbled notes I put on the variety of meanings in this word. Can I do that? Am I boring you already? I mean, I've got, we're on the first language here. I see what this, I wrote down. It's to slip out, to carry away safe, to deliver. Now, they don't have tenses like we do. As I've said to you many times in the Hebrew, they only have perfect and imperfect. Perfect is something that's finished, completed. Imperfect, still going on. That's it. They don't have our way of expressing tenses of verbs. They have stems. They have a stem, a simple active. And they have another stem, which is root letters, to which they add prefixes, suffixes, and infixes. That's intensive. They have another stem for causative. They have another stem for intensively causative. They have different stems, seven main stems that you have to memorize. It drives you crazy. But this, it's worth it once you do it. These are in the, what's known as the PL, imperfect. The job's still going on, which means he doesn't just do it once, he keeps doing it. He's going to keep on doing it, and it's intensive. It's not just, Scott's down there in trouble and he's hollering. Dave will go shout at him and tell him it'll be okay. Can you somehow take care of that? We got more important things to do. Intensive attention. Yea, to me, I'm on the wrong page. Yea, to me, he devotedly holds, and I will deliver him. Will lift him out. You know what? I look for ways to make you remember words. I think you remember this one. You know this word, this verb, right in the middle of that circle there? Pilat. We have an English word, not used often unless you're in the farming business, to calve. To calve. C-A-L-V-E. And you know what happens when you calve. But we have this problem with horses occasionally. Our trainers or the vet has to help. We graphic so you'll remember this. Help pull it out. Why do you think we call certain sections of the hospital the delivery room? Huh? And there are times they need help. You heard Bill Cosby's monologue. They had the breathing exercises, and they were going to have natural childbirth. And he's sitting there like Johnny Bench, breathing with her, and she, at the first contraction, screams, "I want morphine!" She wanted out. That's what this word means. That means God to those that devotedly hang on to Him. Whatever my problem, we've already talked about some of the problems as we preached through this series. This morning, I get up and face whatever I face. I can try to deliver myself as the first instinct, or I can pause long enough to recite the words. Yes, I don't have to prove to God I love Him. He gave me another life. 2 years ago, October, I was told I had 10 months to live. God, I talked to Wally George this week. He said, "You didn't have surgery?" "No, I had no surgery, had no radiation. The doctor said I had 10 months to 12 months to live if I didn't." God healed me. I have a second life. So I have to prove to God I love Him. He knows it. But that's not the criteria that gets His help. The criteria is devotedly turning to, grabbing hold of, claiming Him. How do you do that? With the heart, man believes, with the mouth, proclamation is made. This is my promise. Yea, to me, the other way. Yea, to me, He devotedly hangs on, and I intensively and continuously will set Him free. We'll set Him free. Oh, I've shared with you as a congregation, I've unloaded a lot of staff people that weren't running, they wouldn't even walk with a footman, much less running the race. Good people, still welcome in the church. But I'm starting over at 73. Done what no bureaucracy has ever been able to do. I'm hanging on to Him, and my promise is, yay, to me, He devotedly claims, and I will calve Him. I'll pull Him out if I have to. I'll get Him free. I'll set Him free. I don't know what your problems are, but that's what God promises. He'll set you free. Boy. What's the next one? I will lift Him on high. That's where all these translations come from. I, the personal pronoun. I, again, PL, intensive, imperfect, continuous. I will lift Him up. Let me give you some translations on that word because it's so critical to all these other translations. The verb, as always, three letters, get away. Three letters in the middle. Oh, God trying to give me a message or not. There's your verb, shagab. To be or cause to make lofty, especially inaccessible, safe, strong, defend, set on high. But the root meaning is to be made inaccessible. To put you, in this choice of the Hebrew word, above the problem. Unreachable. It has a root. It has a root. That is in some words for castle. It just sets you on high. Now, this is what the promise is saying. Because to me, he devotedly holds on, and I will calve him or set him free and set him above it all. That's what the Hebrews say. When Jerome did his Latin Vulgate, first he did a sort of cursive translation of the Psalms from the Septuagint. Then he did a very thorough translation after exposure to Origen's work in his Hexapla. He did a very thorough Greek translation, or a translation into the Latin from the Greek, Septuagint, which had been translated from the Hebrew, 3rd to 1st century B.C. His greatest work was to subsequently translate the Psalms and the Old Testament, the portions he did, directly from the Hebrew. His translation from the Greek was first done, twice. His translation from the Hebrew was the second one he did. And most Hebrew Bibles, or most Vulgate Bibles, will have both side by side in the Psalms. In my case here, to show you something, even though he did the translation from the Hebrew second, I've written his translation from the Hebrew, the Vulgate from the Hebrew, right under the Hebrew, even though he did that after he did one from the Greek. And he says, "Quonia mihi adhesit." We get our word adhesive from that, so you can see he has picked up on the use of to cling. It's to bind and unite, but carries with it the message of devoted motive, binding and uniting. But he picks up, as he translates straight from the Hebrew, he picks up adhesit, from which, I repeat, we get adhesive, to stick. So you can tell he's, because in me he sticks or holds together or clings, and they pick up this because every time, which makes the "and" very awkward, because they're just literally going, instead of treating this, as I said, as an asseverative, which is to interject or exclaim, which is allowable as an alternate for this Hebrew word key. If they said yea, we wouldn't be picking up this because all the time. But because they chose because in a lot of the translations, it just carries on and on and on. So he says, awkwardly, because in me he sticks, and I will free him. Exaltabo, I will exalt him. You know where that's coming from by just looking at the words, right or wrong. Can you see it? You can easily see he's gone directly to the Hebrew, even though that was his later translation, to do this version of the Vulgate, which ruled for 1,000 years and longer on the continent. The Septuagint, done before any Vulgate, this is the Vulgate from the Hebrew. This is the Hebrew. And the assumption is, well, the Hebrew's older. Yes. And it would be wonderful if the Dead Sea Scrolls, which has a version of this passage, was marred and damaged. And someone has used license to put it together according to their pet theory. The problem is, yes, the Hebrew's older, but we don't have the oldest manuscripts. Most of your Hebrew Bibles come out of a 10th century manuscript. The Septuagint, the scholars who translated from the 3rd to the 1st century B.C. probably had access to scrolls that were organized by Ezra. Their translation from the Hebrew to the Greek was based upon manuscripts that they had access to, beginning in the Torah, 3 centuries before Christ. And from the 3rd to the 1st century, they completed the Septuagint, which translated the Old Testament from the Hebrew that they had, and this Greek Old Testament was the Bible being used. Most of the Hebrews, when they came back from Babylon, never relearned Hebrew. Greek was the language of the land. And the Bible for the Jews when Jesus came on the scene was the Septuagint translation from the Old Testament Hebrew into Greek. So when you say, well, old is better, I have a natural inclination right now to agree with that. I mean, I have a sign on a door in my basement that says, I bought it over some little town on the coast, says, they say, old is better. I'm approaching magnificent. And I said, I need that sign. I'm going to put it on my door. And if you believe I believe that, you're crazy. We do with what we have. Old is not necessarily better. If we had access to the same manuscripts that the Septuagint translators were using, we might be entitled to question their choice of words to translate that Old Testament manuscript. But I'm not as inclined to accept, particularly, a movement to produce an established Jewish text as a reaction to the Christianizing of the Septuagint. There's a bias built in at the outset. If the purpose of producing this Masoretic text, which is the current Hebrew text, is because of a resentment to the fact that the Bible of the Jew of the first century, the Septuagint, had become the Christian Bible, and we therefore want to distinguish ourselves separately and develop a Hebrew Bible, I'm enough of a scholar and an academic to know you've got an inbuilt predisposition for bias. Doesn't mean they are, but it means I don't necessarily think that the Hebrew text, based on manuscripts of the 10th century A.D., in many cases, is necessarily more accurate than the Septuagint, which was based upon manuscripts 3 centuries before Christ. And the next question is, well, how old are these Greek texts of the Septuagint? Well, we got 3 of them down there that go to 340 A.D., 2 of them, and 1 to the 5th century. And we've got papyri and other copies that I've taken from museums that take us clear back to the 2nd century. So we got a pretty good copy for the Septuagint. Perfect? No. But when in doubt, I give respect to the Septuagint translators who had access to older Hebrew manuscripts. And what did they say? Well, they said, because too, though this is also can be used as a ejaculative or spontaneous bursting forth of yea, but primarily because in me, what's the word they pick for hashak, eel, pisan? And you don't have to go very far to find root letters for the New Testament word for faith. This happens to be the word which is normally translated hope. Hope, eel, pisan, with no exceptions I know about, which means it's massively in the majority. The Septuagint, in every case, uses eupesin, or a derivative form of the word from which the roots of this one come, to translate, listen close, the talk. As the pastor earlier mentioned, that word, which means to lean, or to seek support from something and put your weight on it, like the chair. One of the three most oft-used words for faith, all three of which are translated with the New Testament word, the verb pisteuo, the nouns in various forms, pisteo, pisteos, piston. This word being chosen by the Septuagint scholars to translate what has been alternately, because of the devotional meaning of the word and the clinging aspect or united or adhesive aspect of the word, it's been almost exclusively translated as love or cling. But the Septuagint version, those scholars, knowing something maybe about the language of the day we don't know, chose the word that they also use, almost without exception, to translate the word for faith. Are you still with me? The talk, which means, like we have many English words that can interchange synonymously, what the Septuagint translators put their finger on is faith. As I said earlier in this message, love happens. Faith is exercised. And these Septuagint writers translated from this more ancient Hebrew that they had and chose the word for hope and faith that's used interchangeably throughout the Septuagint. Now, that puts a twist I can understand. Yea, in me he hopes and leans, because the leaning is faith, which is the substance of things hoped for. And therefore, the direction for hope in God is leaning on His promises. The Septuagint writer is saying, yea, in me, he hopes. Yea, in me, he leans. Yea, in me, his clinging is a faith act. And rousomai, I will set him free. There's not much argument in the translations of this word. I will set him free. But then we come to the ambiguous in meaning set on high in the Septuagint translators, and I will free him. Skepasso. You'll recognize this word from earlier verses where we talked about the shadow of God. Skepasso is covering. It's a protective covering. In the case of the motherhood of God and the shadow of the mother, you know, carried with that poetic meaning, you've got a mother who is as close as her shadow, ever ready to help. The Septuagint translators decided to make the root meaning of this word on high, which in its essence of meaning is to put beyond danger, to achieve that same purpose in a more meaningful way, because we are not yet going to be put up there where God is. The beauty of the promises is He comes where we are. And the Septuagint people, for whatever reason, having manuscripts at their disposal, chose skepasso, which is covering. I can make a lot more sense of that. Now, because he devotedly leans on me, and I've told you how to do that, but the heart man believeth with the mouth, profession is made, you find the promise, you make it yours. Because he devotedly leans on me, yea. In other words, I visualize the scene of the three voices. And I've done it this way sometimes, assuming the first voice is angels. talking about this is available. And the psalmist responds with faith, with his mouth. I will say to the Lord, I will say to the Lord, my shelter, my fortress, my God, I'm going to camp out here in your courtyard in the air of your promise. God's looking on. He sees that response when you and I come to that stage. And here's where I get imaginative. I can see him stand up and say, to all these angels been looking on, mouthing his promises, yea, he, to me, he devotedly, favoringly, trusts, and I will deliver him, calve him, set him free, and not I will set him on high, yes, ultimately, but I'll come down and cover him. I will make him inaccessible with my shadow and my covering. Now, when Jerome began to translate from the Septuagint, which he did first, the Latin changes. Quoniam, in me, speravi, which is hope rather than adhesit. And I will free him remains unchanged. As I said, nobody's having any trouble with this one. It's setting free. The problem is here and here. I will set him free, liberabo him, and changes from exaltabo to protegum. I will protect him. You see the different change? How the flow of the language from the Hebrew, he's quickly taking the literal, yea, to me, he clings, adhesit, I will set him free, liberabo, I will set him on high, exaltabo, but the Greek in the Septuagint changes this clinging, which is a bit ambiguous, to hope, faith in action, to cling to God, which is done through claiming His Word, and that one who clings in that manner, the Iopeson, is set free and is covered. Translating the Latin for that, because in me he hopes I will free him and protect him. Now, Luther, I'm taking him in the pattern. We get our English Bible from Tyndale, and if you go down next to the room of the book, you'll see some of the copies, including the only copy in the world of his translation of Joshua. It's the only one. And Tyndale's the father of the English language. Likewise, Luther was the father of High German. There's two Germans, High and Low German. His Bible did it. Luther is translating and influenced Tyndale, which is why when you go in the room of the book, we have the early versions of Luther's translation, a lot of the German versions, because when Tyndale was banished from England to produce the first English Bible, the morning star of the Reformation, Wycliffe, did a translation from the Latin to the English. But after the fall of Constantinople, Tyndale had the manuscripts, and Luther had the manuscripts to go back to the Greek and the Hebrew. And I've often said, to show you the ignorance of the clergy of the day, they accused these translators of corrupting God's holy word, the Latin Vulgate, with heathen tongues like Hebrew and Greek. That's how ignorant they were. Luther utilized for his Old Testament Syriac, Hebrew, and the Vulgate. And he obviously had access to the Septuagint, but he put most of his emphasis, as Jerome would later, on the Hebrew. So, when Luther got around to translating, he was going to reveal his sources pretty quickly. Erbegert, mine. Pretty simple. He covets, or he wishes and wants and desires, the nature of his heartthrob, in essence, is me. Er, begert mein. So, or therefore, will ich ihm aushelfen. He loves me. He desires me. He covets me. His heart fastens toward me. Therefore, I will aushelfen, two words, out, aush, and helfen, from which we get help, to help. I will help him out. But to the grammarians, I want to point something out. You almost miss it. Up here, the personal pronoun for him is ihm. Ihm. And here, later on, it's ihn. This is the dative. The dative is the two or four case. And in, just take my word for it and then go check the grammar books. It personalizes the verb. This is a personal relationship. So in essence, what is being said in the German by Luther is because his heart, his desire, his wants are me, so will I out-help, be his, I'm going to make a word up, be his helper-outer. I will help him out in the dative case that to him, for him, whether he does anything or not, other than setting his heart on me, I will help him out. You can see him, and instantly, Luther's hung up on love, cling. Then words that come later I'm not going to deal with, er kennet meinen, because he knows my nomen. Forget that for a moment. Therefore, darum will ich ihm schützen. So what the German is saying, I will help him out in the sense of calving, aushelfen, though that's not the normal use in modern German of it, but that's the root in translating this word. And, therefore, will I schützen him. And I have German shepherds that have gone through what's called Schützen 1, or Schützen 1, Schützen 2, Schützen 3. They're trained to be guard dogs. That's why the procedure is called Schützen 1, Schützen 2, Schützen 3. I will guard him. What the German is saying, because the heart and the wants and the will focused on me, so will I focus on him and be his out-helper, his helper-outer, his deliverer, if you want to interpolate rather than translate. And I will be, direct object here, accusative, I will be his schützen. I will be schützen to him. I will be his guard. I will be his protector. So it's easy to see that he has followed the Hebrew of clinging, heart focus, has followed, no problem always with this calving, delivering, help out. And then he has followed the second translation of the Vulgate, the Greek, or rather the first translation of the Vulgate that translated the Septuagint, protegum, instead of exultabo. So he mixes. Using the Vulgate, he chooses Jerome's translation of the Greek. He had access to the Greek, so he mixes them. He has love, going back to the Hebrew, heart love. I'll help him out. Both the Hebrew and the Greek agree. And then he changes and chooses protection to go along with protegum, and to go along with skepasso from the Greek. Are you, this is pretty tight, I understand it. But you see how the translator for the German is hunting and pecking between the two. You follow that? Let me keep going. Obviously, the English have already handled it. They go to the Hebrew. There's just something glamorous about saying, well, I went back to the Hebrew behind everything else. Because he set his love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. We'll set him on high. So again, different from the German, Tyndale apparently didn't agree with Luther. Instead of protection, we're back to the Hebrew again, set on high. It's still a protection because you're either above it, inaccessible, or covered and inaccessible. Let's go to the French. Oh, my God. Frisquille. Même, je le délivrerai. Je le protégerai. Because he loves me, I will deliver him. I will protect him. Thank God we got something simple. Give the French credit for that. Because he loves me, but they're still on the Hebrew frame of love, I will deliver him. There's not been any trouble at all through the Greek, through all the languages, with this palat, which is to set free. I will deliver him and protect him. So here we see, following the Septuagint, skepasso, instead of the covering, or rather the high place, it's a covering, it's protection, the German Greece and the French. So there's a mixture here of using the Greek and the Greek translation of the Vulgate for protection rather than on high. The Spanish I can't figure out. That got me up a tree. But I got a lot of Latino people here that can wrestle with this. Por cuanto en mí ha puesto su amor. For how much? Or loosely because, but for how much in me, or seeing as how he is in me, has placed his love. So we're right back to the Hebrew again, emphasizing love rather than faith. But this throws me for a loop. Yo también, I also, lo libraré. I know enough Spanish. I may not have a good ear for it, but I know the grammar. Lo is the definite article for it. Not the definite article, I mean the direct pronoun for it. Not the indirect. It's the direct pronoun for it. Not he, it. And what is being said here is, for how much in me he has placed his, or put his love, or said it, I also, God speaking, will free it. This is the future tense of the brar to free, and this is direct object, it. Now, I can't make sense of that, and it's not a misprint in the Raini version, because they go on and use the direct object for him, le, French is come from out, le, pondre, future of to put or set or place, I will place him on alto, on high. So I know that the translator knows the difference between lay and low. Low is it, and lay is him. But like the Italian said about English, if it's a crazy English, if it he be to him, then why can't she be to shim? There's nothing more complicated in these Latin languages than their use of direct and indirect object, pronouns. I don't understand for how much in me he has placed his love for, or due to it, or because in me he has placed his love, I also will free it. Now, I can philosophize and think, okay, the love has been misplaced and attached to other things. And when you turn your love focus toward God, he also will free that love from these other attachments And thus, it makes sense, I will free it. I will wrestle with this till Jesus comes. And it's put right in here in the middle for us to see how the various translations choose to do these things. I don't understand why they didn't say, for inasmuch as in me he has placed his love, I also will free him. Because they go on to say, I will put him on high. They use him here, then if a he be, if a him be the him here, why isn't a he the him there? Now I can, as I said, I can philosophize and understand, and maybe there's a misprint going back through centuries with reina. I don't know. You Spanish people can write me letters about this, but it's la librare, free it, but the common denominator is love. It's placed his love. We're back to the Hebrew again, instead of faith and hope. The last one I put here is the Italian. Percioche, Haley, Aposta, in me, tutta la sua fazione, dice il Signore, io lo libero e lo levero ad alto. Now, this is for that or because that he has placed their form, and different than the Spanish, which are puesto, aposta is the Italian, in me. This is crazy, too. I mean, in the Spanish, it's in me. In is en. In the Italian and the Latin, in is in. In me, in the Spanish, is mi, and me. God did a real wonderful job at Babel, didn't he? Because he has placed in me, tutta, all la sua affezione, all his affection, they put in, because of the and over there, they put in, dice il Signore, says the Lord, or the Lord says, io, I, you say io fast, and it's like yo in the Spanish, io, lo, libero. In this case, the right pronoun, I will free him, and lo levero, I will lift him up on high. I worked awfully hard to try to get you to see that you can trace through many languages, and you're able to pretty much see where'd they get this, and where are they coming from? And I'm going to bring this message to a conclusion by saying, I've made my decision. My decision is, when in doubt, I'm taking the Septuagint, because I can see that every one of these famous translators and famous translating committees hunted and picked between the Hebrew version, which is more modern in its manuscripts, and the Septuagint version, and what Luther, not Luther, but Jerome did in translating from the Hebrew one psalm and translating from the Greek another psalm parallel. I've made my choice. All this poetic language, you know, major romantic that I am, leaves me somewhat dead in understanding how I'm to appropriate this wonderful promise from God. And the very illustrations, I think, give me the license to make a choice. And I'm making it obvious what the choice is. I go with these guys that translated from the Hebrew to the Greek with older manuscripts who tell me that because I place my hope, trust, devoted grabbing hold of, which is not alien to the Hebrew at all, because of that faith act, because of that I'm going to hang on And faith is the substance of things hoped for, and I'm going to hope in Him that His Word is going to be worked out in my life, and I can claim this promise. That makes sense to me. Therefore, in me, He hopes, and I will set Him free. No problem there. Every single word, every single translation agrees, will be delivered, set free. I like the calving illustration that comes out of the Hebrew. I'll be set free because I set my trust in Him, and He will cover me. He will deliver me. He will make me inaccessible because of that same reason I'm trusting Him. Now, having said all that, let me show you something. At their worst and at their varieties, the message still comes through. Cling, the Hebrew includes devoted motive in the clinging, which is trust. You cling because you trust. Clinging trust, or elpison, hopeful trust, or any one of the other words, you'll be set free. That's the promise. And they all agree on that. Whether you put the emphasis on the clinging or the emphasis on the motive, with all of the differences, the same message comes through. The one that's close to God, hanging on to Him, elaborated by the Greek because His Word gives a promise and you can trust Him, you'll be set free, you'll be delivered. And whether you're set on high or covered, you're made inaccessible from harm. You understand that? So through the centuries, wrestling earnestly to try to find what is it that this psalmist really said, the deviations are so minor. I've made a lot out of it to make the point. The deviations are so minor. You can take your reina. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they say it's setting your love free or setting you free. You generically know that if you put your trust in Him, He's going to set you free. If you put your trust in Him, He's going to make you immune or covered or inaccessibly above the trouble. And all you've got to do is do it. The faith action. Trust in Him. With mouth, with heart you believe, with mouth you say it. That's my message. Now, it's offering time, and don't anybody leave till it's finished. The song in tune with the message. You in trouble today? Run to Him. Roll it off on Him. How do I do that? The heart man believeth. The words are empty if you don't believe. With the mouth, you claim it. You talk to yourself as you leave here. You say, you know, this really is my promise. I can dwell in this zone, and I can commit my way to Him. And because I trust Him, have hope in Him, cling to Him with that devoted trust, He will free me. It may take a while to untie the knots I've tied. He'll cover me. Either way, He'll either lift me above it or He'll cover me and shield me because I put my trust in Him. The song's in tune with that. Where could I go but to the Lord? Sit down, please, and let the offering be taken, and then you're dismissed at the close of the song. Thank you. 56. A lot of you that watch at this hour don't know that we're on from 2 to 4:30 every day. On Sunday, we're on a total of 4.5 hours. 2 to 4:30 in the afternoon and 8 to 10. But we still have about 7 minutes for your reactions. I sit here and I look to, you know, I'm just preaching. I don't hear my message. I'm on the other end of it. But I got in and saw. And I'm sort of bemused. I hope it encourages you. The most important word in all of those different translations, absolutely the most important one, was the Greek Septuagint, iopisin. I even circled P-I-S as part of the root for the word for faith, but it's hope. And it reminds me of some months back when I put evangelion on the board. And spelled it with two L's instead of one. Remember that? I did an inversion. I just saw it. I said, am I getting dyslexic or what? I spelled it in the Greek letters, E-L-I-P-S-E-N, ellipsin, and all the time I'm pronouncing it, iopisin, writing so fast, and then I'm trying to, how did I do that? And then I decided, you know, my wife was singing, and I was listening to her while I was writing it down. So next Sunday, because I'm not finished with that. That was the heavy part. Next Sunday I can pull the string together because it leads into the rest of what God promised. And the major point was to show you, yeah, they're right on. Cling is in the Hebrew word. I wanted to demonstrate, no matter what the little variations, Bible translators, for the most part, are honest people. You have a bigger problem today with modern translations trying to twist things for a personal bias than you do the historic translations through the centuries. There was a time, probably in Christianity, most people don't measure up to the Muslim people who almost worship their book. Now, I'm not a Biblolater. I don't worship the book. I worship the God who spoke to us, and I want to know to the best of my ability what he said. But the historic translators wanted to get it right. But the having said that, and the minor deviations still leave the major thrust for practical life application, it's tragic that they have tended to follow the major meaning of the Hebrew word hasak instead of hilpison, which is faith and hope mixed in. Because practically you can start the faith walk, and love comes because of God's response. And it's a message for beginners, not just mature saints who've learned about God enough for their love to flow. I'm trying to reach the guy out there that wants to know, how does this apply to my life? And the tragedy I was trying to show with all of the translations is how they continued to go back behind the Septuagint, which was really not behind it, because we don't have old enough manuscripts, and departed from the wonderful translation of the Septuagint, which puts the emphasis on faith, and faith is the substance of hope, and it is not those that are just gushing and loving God that he will deliver, it's those who will trust him. That was the essence of the message. I'll correct the spelling next Sunday, but that, I think it's ironic that the one word that's most important, I had to invert those two letters. I want your response to the message, and I want your calls in the minutes that follow. If you enjoy being on 56, it's a lot of time to be on 4.5 hours. And if you like this 2 hours on Sunday night, I'd like to hear from you. Let me know it. Get on the telephone.